Joining us from Amman, Jordan, is Jonathan Fowler, Senior Communications Manager at UNRWA. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us. I wanted to ask you, so you were in Jerusalem yesterday when some Israeli residents of occupied East Jerusalem set fire twice to the perimeter of UNRWA headquarters. Can you tell us what happened?
Just for context, we have a pretty small presence physically in the office for the reason that our colleagues who are from the West Bank are unable to get permits to come into Jerusalem currently. They've not been able to since the start of the war in Gaza. So that means that we're a fairly small team, and then in the evening a smaller team. But there's kind of people dotted around the compound in their various offices. Now, I was actually in the middle of speaking to a journalist on the phone when another colleague came and said, "Did you hear the fire alarm?" And I suddenly realized when I took out my headphones, yes, the fire alarm was ringing. And we looked out of the window and I saw smoke kind of billowing over the top of the building. And you started to smell it, when I opened the window. And so, colleagues went out to take a look. And in the meantime, our director of UNRWA affairs for the West Bank field office, Adam Boulakos, he and another colleague had gone out with fire extinguishers and a hose to try to take control of this fire, which had been lit in the there's kind of undergrowth outside the compound, around the metal fence that we have. It had been lit through that, and it had kind of come through the fence because it's just like a chicken wire fence. Come through and was actually setting fire to the grass and getting close to the trees, which are right next to our buildings. So the colleagues there, despite the very, very heavy smoke, because undergrowth when it burns like that gives off very, very heavy smoke, they managed to kind of douse the fire at either end so it wouldn't spread further. And in the meantime, they were treated to stone throwing by groups of youths who had gathered on the street opposite. There were people cheering the fact the fire was burning, and stone throwing. Now, these are the same groups of youths who regularly come after school's out most evenings to throw stones at our main entry gate, and to hit the cars, to try to hit personnel when they're walking out on foot. And this has been a constant problem for several weeks. But just to go back to the fire, the fire brigade came after a little while. In the meantime, we'd called the police multiple times to get them to come too, and they did come in the end. But so the fire was put out by the fire brigade, and then we discovered there was another fire burning on the other side of the compound. Now, it was already bad enough, the one that was burning, getting close to the trees, and close to the buildings. But the one that was burning on the other side, we have a gas station inside the UNRWA compound, for our own vehicles and everything. And the fire had been lit on the fence right next to that gas station. Now, I dread to think what would have happened if, because this fire was sort of out of sight. We were all focused on the other one. It was caught on the security cameras. There was very little we could do about it initially. If that fire had worked its way in and had actually reached the gas station, something extremely dangerous would have happened, not just for us, but actually for the people who live in the area around us. Now, I want to emphasize, our offices are located in occupied East Jerusalem. And there's a lot of what, classed as colonies, settlements rather, in that area. And then the demographic of the kids that come and throw stones is from that area. So by lighting a fire, whoever did it, and the police have said it was children, but fire is fire, still as hot, whoever lights it. If that fire had reached the gas station, I dread to think what would have happened to the houses or the apartment blocks that live right nearby. We could have been in a situation of an absolute disaster. So that's the context of what physically happened. There's an investigation being ongoing. Like I said, the police have said it was kids, but just kids. I mean, kids behave in bad ways sometimes in places around the world, but there's a sense that this kind of behavior has been encouraged and encouraged and encouraged by inflammatory rhetoric. So we go from inflammatory rhetoric to real flames in the space of a few days.
Right. So I just wanted to follow up a little bit about the arson itself. So you said that, and Mr. Lazzarini yesterday said that the director himself went out with staff and started putting out the fire. How long did it take for police and firefighters to arrive.
I mean, I'm trying to remember the timeline because it was all a bit of a rush, to be honest. I mean, the firefighters were probably there within maybe 15 minutes or something like that. The police longer, which is slightly surprising, but you know, we have underscored that you know, there have been demonstrations outside our compound repeatedly, and the role of the police, you know, it's become less front response times and reactions seem to have been a bit slower, which we, you know, is not something that is helpful in our view. But I'm not going to, you know, bash the police on this or anything like that. I mean, you know, it's a part of a much wider context, which is how serious is something like this taken when it happens, but why does it even happen at all?
Right. So you're saying that police are saying that this was done by kids from the area, but you know there have been increased tensions around UNRWA's work. Is there an increased police presence? Have you been in contact with Israeli authorities on beefing up their presence around the facility?
There's no noticeable increased police presence despite the repeated demonstrations that we've had. And of course, you know, I mean, we do speak to the police every time. I mean, the context, the very specific context for Thursday's arson, it came 2 days after an incident on Tuesday where, you know, there have been repeated demonstrations called by different organizations and individuals. And some of the most prominent ones are called by one of the deputy mayors of Jerusalem. And the sharpness of the rhetoric about us has increased at those rallies. So when they began, you know, the police brought in metal barriers and it was kind of more policed in a way, you know, and it was more like giving out leaflets and shouting slogans. You know, we have no problem with freedom of expression, even if we don't agree with the content of what is shouted at us. What's happened is that that has kind of sort of moved into a territory of intimidation. You know, people blocking the gate, but then when colleagues, you know, on one occasion a colleague tried to drive in, and the car was surrounded, and it happened that the demonstrators had brought toy weapons with them as part of a, you know, happening that they were organizing, and they brandished these toy weapons in the face of the colleague and were yelling at the colleague in the car. So the colleague was very fearful about what was going on. Other colleagues who've been leaving, we have shuttle buses that leave, you know, on a regular basis. And those have been, you know, people have sort of slapped the side of the bus. They've yelled, they've filmed the colleagues, they've spat at the bus, you know, they've shown the middle finger, all this kind of stuff. You have that kind of context. Now then on Tuesday this week, you know, we know when these rallies are going to happen. We're informed, you know. The gathering happened on Tuesday about 6 p.m. The police were there. You know, people were gathering, and they were starting to get, you know, wooden sticks and stones, and there was some sort of bash against the gate. And the police were just kind of there, you know, in the background. Now, that's a choice, you know. I mean, I know there are different methods of crowd control in different places, different tactics depending on circumstances, but the problem was that gradually the crowd that was there on Tuesday started to get louder and louder and louder. And then they started to pick up rocks. There's a couple of construction sites on the roadworks near our compound, which have been there for quite some time. So, you know, there's stones readily available. And, you know, large, you know, hand-size rocks started flying over the fence. These rocks were kind of pounding onto the roof of the security gate. To the security guard's office, which is right next to the gate. You know, the guards had to sort of get out of the way of this rain of stones. There were adults among the crowd, although the crowd was largely young, you know, teenage boys and younger than teens. Couple of adults, you know, walking not in uniform but with assault rifles, which of course is not completely uncommon in Jerusalem, but still, you know, the context is that this is not appropriate because, as Philippe Lazzarini has flagged, you know, several times, when elected officials call for this kind of behavior, and in fact, when their response to our criticism is, yeah, let's do more of this, you know, that's completely out of line. There is such a thing as international diplomatic practice, you know, customs in di diplomacy and also international law. And the United Nations, like an embassy, for example, is meant to benefit from the protection of the local authorities. Now, I use the term local authorities there because it could be the host country, or in the case of East Jerusalem, the West Bank and wherever, it is Israel as the occupying power. Being an occupying power is still incumbent upon you as a power to ensure the proper protection of UN facilities. Now, we feel this is not happening. I mean, it's clear from the evidence, and it's part of a much wider context against the context of a much wider campaign against UNRWA, basically to undermine the agency. Things like use of lawfare to try to argue that legally we have no right to be in our compounds. But you know, there's a rather curious thing that we've noticed, which is when the deputy mayor of Jerusalem, and I'm not making this personal, but it's just a little odd thing that we notice, when the deputy mayor of Jerusalem calls for demonstrations, he mentions we're going to kick you out of three locations, and he talks about the compound in East Jerusalem that is our main offices, another one in Calandia, which is nearby, and he refers to a third one in a location called French Hill in Jerusalem. And people have gone and demonstrated at his call against UNRWA there. Problem is, we don't have an office there. In fact, it's a European Union office. Now, you have to ask yourself, what exactly is going on there and why?
Yeah. I want to come back to the point of your office being closed now. But first, I wanted to ask you about this intimidation, rock throwing that you mentioned, Philippe Lazzarini mentioned. Is this only in and around the work area, or is this also following staff home? Are they also subject to this kind of intimidation after work hours?
Fortunately, we haven't had cases of that. Although before this rock throwing at the gate happened, we had a couple of cases where staff, cars at stoplights, for example, have been kicked, guns have been pointed at staff in the area. But that's not, you know, people being followed out from work, as far as we can tell. I mean, that would obviously be the next step. We have to hope sincerely that we don't get to that level, because, you know, we retain our status as United Nations personnel, whether we're in the compound or whether we're somewhere else. That would be, you know, it would be something very, very sinister if that started to happen. I mean, the fact that staff have been filmed, our images get posted on social media. You never know. But we have to hope sincerely that we don't get to that kind of level.
Yeah. And from your discussions with your colleagues, from your personal view, do you still feel safe being able to work in East Jerusalem?
Yes. I mean, you know, we all have to, anywhere that we work in the UN, you know, we have security advice. We know the context. We're always, you know, situational awareness is always essential. You know, keep a low profile, those kind of things. Don't walk around, you know, with an UNRWA hat on. I mean, I'm being slightly flippant there, but those kind of things, which are, to be honest, are kind of self-evident, you know, wherever we work. You know, when you're off duty, you're off duty, but, you know, you are still who you are. You remain a UN civil servant, so you have to have that situational awareness. I mean, various people have asked, you know, are you fearful about what might come? You know, local colleagues, our local colleagues are Palestinians. You know, sadly, this is their life, and has been for many years. So, you know, they are used. I mean, nobody should have to get used to this kind of thing, but being situationally aware is something which is essential. Many of the rest of us, the international staff, you know, we are the minority of staff working for UNRWA. It's almost entirely Palestinians. We've worked in places where, you know, we have staff at UNRWA in active war zones, but, you know, people have been in places like, you know, myself, I've been in Ukraine, Afghanistan. So you kind of know how to read the environment, know what to do or not to do, but it's... I mean, Philippe Lazzarini has talked about an insidious campaign against us, and that's really what it's about. It's as if, you know, one day it might be you'll be dodging a rock. The next day, you know, they might send a letter saying, someone might send a letter saying you have no right to rent your compound. The next day it might be, you know, the bank account gets closed, or, you know, we've had issues where, you know, Israeli companies, for example, in ports where we've been doing unloading, they've been told by senior officials, you know, don't work with UNRWA or you'll get blacklisted, this kind of thing. So we have that. And this is very much the context in East Jerusalem, of course. And but, you know, I want to situate this also in the overall context, you know, beyond this course to dismantle UNRWA by all means possible, multi-pronged sort of attack on us. I mean, the most egregious example, of course, of what's happening is the fact that our facilities in the West Bank, which are UN facilities, have been hit multiple times, more than 160 times. In the Gaza Strip, I misspoke there. In the Gaza Strip, you know, our facilities have been hit more than 160 times. Tragically, we've lost over 188 of our staff, including in the line of duty, you know, killed in their place of work. You know, we've had staff detained, tortured, you know, subjected to brutal interrogation techniques to extract information, these kind of things. And these are UN civil servants. So that's the most egregious example of what we're facing, the fact that the United Nations flag does not protect, unable to protect when a choice is made in that context. And then to refer to the West Bank, as I mentioned, our colleagues from the West Bank are unable to come to the office if they don't have Jerusalem permits, which means that they're working almost in like COVID-like situation, having to work from home. Colleagues whose work is in the West Bank and who live there, many cases they've had to be redeployed to different parts. For example, somebody who lives in Ramallah and works in Bethlehem, which should be a short drive, you know, may or may not be able to get to work, so they now have to sort of do something different. We've had repeated intimidation against our staff operating in the West Bank. I myself, when going on mission in the West Bank to visit a sewage rehabilitation project in the West Bank, which had been destroyed by an Israeli forces incursion, I was held up at a checkpoint on a road where I was perfectly entitled to be driving. Didn't argue because, of course, we have... you know, we state the fact that we are going about our legitimate business, but had a gun pointed at me and was told to go away. Now, what we do in such situations, what can we do? Well, we send a letter of protest to the Israeli authorities documenting exactly what happened. And that's precisely what we've been doing about the incidents which took place, the arson attack and the vandalism on Tuesday night. So we make these, you know, what the diplomatic démarche, basically. And we just have to hope there will be concrete results from that.
So now your office is closed. Do you expect that you'll be able to reopen it? And how has that closure affected your work?
Well, we're doing constant situational assessments, of course. So as it stands, you know, it's very hard to speculate on what the next step will be. But we've clearly stated that we need the correct guarantees of safety and security for the premises and the personnel in order to be able to function correctly. So until such time as we get those, then, you know, it's an open question of how long we will have to stay closed. How much will this affect our work? I mean, as it stands, as I said, you know, the colleagues delivering education, health services and so on, although work in the West Bank is difficult, they're able to do that there. You know, we have a certain aspect of our work at the compound in East Jerusalem, which really can only be done on site. So then, you know, we'll have to find remote solutions or physical solutions, for example, in the West Bank. But we're having to kind of pivot into almost this COVID-like situation where, you know, the compound is closed, people have to work from home, people have to work from other locations, you know, this kind of thing. Complicates our functioning at a time when, of course, we should be fully focused on unprecedented levels of violence in the West Bank, and it goes without saying the enormous unprecedented level of humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip. That's what we should be able to be focusing on right now. Now, I just wanted to add a point, which is that we called a meeting of supportive countries, our donor countries, to brief them on what had happened. And we were able to show them, you know, what was happening in the compound, what had happened in the compound, the fallout from the fire. And it's been gratifying to see there have been a number of robust public statements from a number of our donor countries saying, you know, enough is enough, this is not acceptable. And of course, from the UN Secretary General overall saying, you know, humanitarians are not a target.
I think my last question is about the general context of this campaign, that it's a stated campaign that Israel wants to end UNRWA. How could you possibly continue working in this kind of an environment?
Well, we have a mandate from the UN General Assembly, which is almost 75 years old, to do a job of work, which is to continue providing services for Palestine refugees until such time as there is a just and lasting solution to what is one of the most protracted refugee crises in modern history. That mandate has been renewed over and over. We're proud of our work. Many of us are deeply passionate about our work, you know. We don't do it for our own pleasure. We do it because we have a mandate from the United Nations system to do something. Until such time as that mandate no longer exists, we're not going anywhere, whatever anybody might like to say. Now, Philippe Lazzarini has spotlighted the fact that, you know, for our detractors, if you somehow do away with UNRWA, and what would that be? Either no longer deliver the services that we deliver in health and education, or try to get other people to do those services. The view is that somehow, you know, removing us from the picture removes the status of Palestine refugees. But that's simply not the case, because this is something which also exists under international law. And so, you know, it's a false solution to a real issue. And the real issue is that there needs to be a just and lasting solution.
Jonathan Fowler, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.